So tonight I'm going to continue with this series I started last week on the Four Noble Truths. So this being the second night of the series, I'm going to do the second noble truth, which sort of makes sense. It's important to remember, before I talk about the second noble truth, it's important to remember the first noble truth isn't negative. You know, we sometimes think, oh, it's so full of talking about suffering all the time. Oh, it's not negative, it's just simply truth. It's reality. It's like this is the truth. You know. And it explains, you know, sometimes we talk about the mindfulness practice is seeing things as they really are. And the first noble truth just basically says, this is how things are. You see them clearly. And the rest of the teaching, you know, what the First Noble Truth talks about, the inevitability of what happens to all of us, without exception. So the Second Noble Truth, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutta, it says, he knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. So what we're supposed to know here is we're supposed to know, where does dukkha come from? Why does it keep arising? And tradition is called the cause of dukkha is tanha. Tanha is often translated as either grasping or craving. Another translation you sometimes see, however, is desire. And I want to point out that that's a not a very good translation of tanha. Desire is, in and of itself, is sort of a neutral mental state. You know, we can have desire that's wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral. You know, you all had wholesome desires to come here today. You know, I had a wholesome desire to figure out how I could keep the baseball scores at the bottom of my screen tonight. And I resisted. I didn't want the distraction of the baseball score. So, but it's like, this is what happens. You know, desires arise. We try, you know, we look at them, and if we're wise, we go, oh, I see. No, that one isn't a good idea. That's not a wholesome idea. So that's desire. So grasping or craving has sort of a note of desperation. I have to have it. I'm like, oh, it'd be nice. And desire is like, oh, it'd be nice if that happened. You know? Grasping is, no, I gotta have it. In fact, often it's like, I gotta have it. I gotta have it right now. Or I have to get away from it. Because grasping has these two flavors of wanting and not wanting. Other translations you sometimes see are thirst, and even unsatisfied longing. It's a little soft from my point of view, but it's like you see those ways of describing it too. And why is grasping such a big problem? And it's basically because grasping leads to, in Buddhist speak, clinging. And now I have to sort of do a little explanation. There is, in the central to the Buddhist teachings and unique to the Buddhist teachings, I would say, something called the 12 steps of codependent arising. So codependent means if A happens, then B has to happen. And if B happened, A must have happened. So they work in both directions, right? And I'm not going to go through the whole 12 steps because that's a giant Dharma talk all in itself. But from our point of view, this is basically what happens. Something arises at one of the sense doors. We become aware of it, of something, whether it's a thought or a sound or some physical body sensation or whatever. Something arises that we become aware of. And then immediately following that noticing arises what's called Vedana. Vedana being a a Pali word that has, it's simple, it only has three sort of qualities. It means everything that arises is, we're going to, Vedana is going to arise, and it's going to be either, oh, that's pleasant, oh, that's unpleasant, neutral, yeah, who cares, right? And following Vedana, grasping arises, because if it's pleasant, then we want more. We reach out, we want to grab hold, we want more, we want to keep it, we want to make it solid and real. It's just the nature of mind, our habitual patterns of mind. And if it's unpleasant, we want to push it away. But to do either of those things, what we have to do is cling to it, right? If we really want something and we want to keep it, we cling to it. When we reach out and grab it, and then we hold on really tight, we pull it in, it's mine. Thoughts of self immediately arise. And thoughts of, now I'm thinking, well, how can I keep this forever? Thoughts of, you know, delusion of how things are permanent arise. But it's also, same is true if we want to push something away. Because if to push something away, we first have to get a really good grip on it. I can't sort of like push it away, go, oh, I'll take my little pinky and go plink, and it's going to float away. I have to grab it and fling it, right? And to do that, we have to cling to it at some point. So when Vedana arises, without us paying attention, without us being mindful, then grasping arises, and then that leads to clinging. And clinging inevitably leads to suffering, because now we have this thing we want to keep, or we want to push it away and it won't go away. Something is not the way we want it to be. The trick, by the way, is if we can be mindful of Vedana itself, of this mental formation that arises after every arising at any of the sense doors, then we can have that moment of choice, like, oh, I don't have to fall into that habitual pattern. But usually we do. That our habitual patterns are that way, and that's why they call them habitual patterns, right? And part of what we're trying to do is learn to see those habitual patterns early on, or maybe even at the stage of Vedana where we're about to, and we go, no, I don't have to do that. I don't have to go there, right? But it's really what the Second Noble Truth is really about, I've sort of been leading up to this, is what is it we actually cling to? What are the things we actually cling to? And how does that happen? And traditionally there's this thought of there's four things we cling to, four categories. And here, oh look, another Buddhist list, what a surprise, right? So the first thing we cling to is sense pleasure through objects. You know, I want that because it tastes good, or it feels good, or it sounds good, or it makes me look wise. You know, something, there's something about that thing, that object, whether it's a physical object or a mental object, that gives us pleasure. Even though we know, if we're smart, that anything that arises, the pleasure that arises due to any of these objects is temporary and goes away. But we don't want to think about that. We just want to keep seeking. I want another one, please. I want another hit, you know. And we somehow think that the next one, the next sensory experience will be the one that lasts. That's the one that's going to make us permanently happy. Or if we're more complex thinkers, we'll think, well, if I just can get all these things I really like and get them all together so that I have every one of them all at the same time and then hold on to them, then I've got everything I want to be happy. And we might actually succeed in doing that for a second or so. And then something changes. one of those things is going to change in some way. That's because that's the nature of everything. Everything's always changing, right? So, but we keep believing somehow. And this is how I, you ever see dogs going for a walk and they're sort of led around by their noses? It's like, oh, that one smells good. Oh, no, maybe there's something over here. It smells better. You know, they just go around sniffing one thing after another, like looking for the next sensory hit. That's like, oh, I want to know this stuff. And there's a couple of great stories I want to share. This one, first one, story. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And this is a famous, I think, teaching story, actually. There's this famous Sufi teacher called Mulla Nasruddin. One day he went to the marketplace and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little while later, his disciple came and saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. "Mullah, mullah, why do you go on eating them?" As he reached for another, Nasruddin said, "I keep waiting for a sweet one." And that's what we do. We keep waiting for the sweet one. You know, despite all this, despite knowing, despite being in the midst of like our mouth burning, we still think somehow there's a sweet one. If I just, I'm patient enough, I just keep taking more, I'll find a sweet one somehow or other, right? And also I want to share, this is Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. And he's talking about this issue. We live in a world where we naturally encounter a wide assortment of appealing sense objects, sights and sounds, tastes, sensations, interesting thoughts and ideas. Desires arise from contact with these pleasing objects, and this desire can range from obsessive passion to addictive craving to a simple passing wish for something. All these gradations of feeling are expressions of the wanting mind. It is important to distinguish here between the desire of wanting associated with greed and with the desire of motivation, which can be joined with either wholesome or unwholesome factors. So this, like he's saying, we desire to have the motivation to come and sit and learn more Dhamma, or to, you know, go for a walk and get some fresh air, or whatever the wholesome, lots of wholesome desires that we have, that have a motivation behind them that is wholesome. In English, we use the same word for these very different mind states. Whereas in Pali, the language of the Buddha, different words distinguish the various meanings of desire. In Pali, the word tanha means the desire of craving. And the word chanda is translated as desire to do. For example, the Buddha, before his enlightenment, had a strong desire for liberation that inspired him for over countless lifetimes to practice. This was chanda, the energy of motivation to accomplish something, in this case associated with faith, wisdom, and compassion, in other words, the wholesome idea. The grasping force of tanha runs very deep in our consciousness. In fact, the Buddha said that this kind of desire or craving is the driving force of samsara, the delusion. This entire round of existence of life and death, desire, wanting, craving, clinging, are all expressions of the greed factor of the mind. We feel it as a thirst for a particular object. We become entranced by the appearance and seduced by the pleasant feeling that accompanies it. At that time, we cannot clearly see the true nature of phenomena, their impermanence and selflessness. Observe carefully what happens to your mind when it becomes entranced in the forest of desire. It's like being lost in an enchanted maze or wrapped in a delusive dream world. We weave many thoughts and fantasies around the experience we either are having or want to have. We bind ourselves in the chains of attachment. It's very strong language from Joseph. Strong desire in our mind not only obscures clear understanding, but also fails finally to deliver the happiness it promises. We seek out different sense pleasures for the pleasant feeling they bring, but those feelings are so impermanent that we need to continually look for another and another. How many pleasant feelings have we already enjoyed? Good question. Too many even to count. And yet we still feel as if something is lacking, something is not complete. Without understanding how or why, we stay on the treadmill, endlessly looking for yet another pleasant experience. It is hardest to cure disease when the medicine we take itself causes the disease. We scratch the itch, and the scratching only makes it worse. We try to quench our thirst by drinking salt water, which makes ourselves thirstier. This is what happens when we believe that the only way to end desire is to fulfill them. And there are whole sets of teaching and traditions where this is the idea. Like, let's just indulge ourselves as much as we possibly can, because we'll get to the end, we'll get bored of wanting. Of course, what actually happens is they just want more and more and more and more. A different and liberating insight dawns when we begin to pay careful attention to this powerful energy in our lives. First, we need to make desire the very object of our attention so that we are fully aware when it arises in our mind. This way, we are no longer simply lost in the feelings or thoughts, but instead we see clearly what is going on. So this is just talking very directly about being mindful. You know, if some craving arises at the level of mind, then we go, oh, it's my old friend craving for baseball scores or whatever it is we're craving for. And then we can just go, and that's okay, but I don't have to do anything about it. I don't have to follow through. I don't have to, you know, think that something is unfair. It's unfair that I can't do X. I can't have Y right now, which is what was one place we often go. It's like, I should be able to just have chocolate ice cream anytime I want, or whatever it is that, you know, your secret desire is. So it's sort of insidious in a way, because, you know, we have these things and we go, oh, that's really nice. And I want to make really clear, there's nothing wrong with having nice stuff. There's nothing wrong with having a pleasant meal and having, you know, a good dessert and whatever else makes a pleasant meal for you, good conversation. All of that's fine. There's nothing wrong with enjoying yourself. It's only when we have to go, we get into the place of, I have to do that right now. I can't wait. It has to be right now, and it has to be exactly this way, and blah, and we get caught up in our whole chain of thoughts about how things should be. And that's when it gets to be a problem. If we're just having something that's nice and we enjoy it, joy's a good thing. Joy's a good thing in our lives. This is when we think that we have to have it, then it turns from joy to suffering. That's the difference that we have to be aware of. So that's the first thing we cling to. The first of this list of four. The second is usually called views and opinions. These are partly intellectual and partly cultural. You know, how we live and how we were brought up. You know, we all have these. And these are more difficult to work with because they often have, they seem so, you know, natural. Well, we hear ourselves saying, well, of course it's that way, or it's always been that way, or my family always did it like that, or my culture believes that, you know, or. But views and opinions are filters that we place. Instead of seeing things as they really are, we see them through these filters of how we think things should be. So something arises, we see it, you know, there it is, but we filter it through our views and opinions, it to be something less than what it is. know, we use the term rose-colored glass, you know, seeing things through rose-colored glasses. Well, sometimes it's rose-colored, sometimes it's black, you know, or some other color. You know, we don't see clearly unless we see that we're actually filtering. We become aware of how our views and opinions affect and distort what we're experiencing to be what we want them to be. You see this all the time, you know, in political discourse, and you see this all the time in all kinds of different ways. You know, I grew up in a very working class, blue collar world. And for a long time, and I still catch myself sometimes doing this, but for a long time, certain things would just set me off and be like, oh, well, you know, that's what those rich people are like. Because they weren't like honest, blue collar, working people. Didn't understand the value of hard work and all that, which was just so much a part of the culture I grew up in. And I judge people just based on that. And then I go, oh, wait. if I'm having a good day, I catch myself, you know, falling into that old habitual pattern. And it's less and less, but it's still there. I don't think these things ever go away. I think they get softer, they get less, and we become more aware of them over time. But the way I've learned to catch myself is when I have that sort of thought in the mind, well, that's how things should be, or that's the way it always has been. So anything like that that sort of implies that, well, I know the right way. And those people don't obviously know the right way. You know, that's when we're caught in filtering reality through our views and opinions. There's I love this. This is from the third Zen patriarch, who, by the way, is like known for having these pithy one-liners. I have several of them I use at various times. I like this one though. It says, do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Do not seek the truth. Only seek to cherish opinions. So if you stop cherishing your opinions, the truth will hit you in the face. It'll be so obvious, it'll be there. But we keep hiding the truth, blotting out the truth, distorting the truth through our views and opinions. This is a difficult part of the practice, and that these are so deeply culturally rooted and rooted in all kinds of ways that we're not even aware of. And I'm sure I'm not aware of all of mine. You know, political beliefs. Beliefs and about sexuality and this and that and morality and all, just think of all the ways we do this. And it's just getting in the way of seeing things as they really are. So that's the second of the ways we cling. Then comes what's called rites and rituals. In the Buddhist time, this was a big deal. Yeah, because the Buddha came in, you know, into the world at a time, 2,600 years ago in North India, where what was called the Brahmanic culture was predominant. You know, the Brahmins, this was in the caste system. The Brahmins were the top level, and basically they controlled the whole society and culture because everything had to be done through a Brahmin priest, through a rite or a ritual to make something happen or to prevent something from happening. You wanted a son, you went to the priest and he did the right ritual so that you could have a son. You wanted good crops or not, you didn't want rain or who knows, anything you can think of, they had rites and rituals for everything. And only the Brahmins could perform these rituals, because all these rituals were written down in the Vedas and the rules they had written down in a language that only they knew, because they were the ones who had time to study and learn the language to know the rituals, had to study them and practice them. Oh yeah, you had to be a man too, of course. It was like women, well, wait till next time round. Right now, take care of the cows and the kids. If you're lucky, next time you'll be a man. Then you can learn these things, maybe. If you're born into a Brahmin family, of course. And the Buddha just basically said, nonsense. Don't cling to any of this stuff at all. Because it's not true. It's just not true at all. It's like comforting. Just like, I'm picking on the Brahmin culture, but pick any sort of cultural belief that has a religious aspect to it. And there's always a layer of comfort there. It's like, well, if I just believe this and let the priests take care of everything, then I don't have to worry. They're going to take care of it all. They've told me if I just believe, then I'm going to go to heaven. And that's all. I'm just going to be great. Right? And if I don't believe them, well, now I'm in big trouble, I think. And that's, it's comforting in the sense that it's easy. I just follow the rules. And I want to make sure you understand, I'm not just talking about, quote, religious cultural things of this nature. I think in our, quote, spiritual culture, the culture of, I mean, I was a hippie, I'm allowed to say this, all those things we talk about, like love and peace, and all those things we talk about all the time, we still do. I mean, there's still hippies around, it's amazing sometimes when I meet them. But there were certain beliefs in that culture that had nothing to do with religion and such, that were like ridiculous, totally ridiculous. If we just love everybody, everything will be okay. Pretending like I can just be full of love all the time, not acknowledging the fact that half the time we're full of nothing but not love. the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Sometimes I have a dark side that comes out. All that stuff is just ignored. Or a thing I run into, I'm a volunteer chaplain at the hospital. I run into this sometimes, where people will say something like, someone is really sick, and someone will come say to them, well, this is all how it should be, because this is, something you did in your past life or whatever. God's testing you or punishing you, or this is the way it should be, because, everything is meant for, everything happens for a reason. Talk about punishing people who are sick enough, sick already, and always add this layer of guilt and nastiness on top of them to make them feel even more miserable. it just drives me crazy when I talk to people, when I talk to people one-on-one, they're expressing these ideas, and I keep saying, no. Stuff just happens, This is like, you're just the unfortunate person at the end of some random event that's now here you are, lying on this bed in the hospital. That's because that's what actually happens. This stuff happens. These are like rites and rituals and beliefs that have this spiritual veneer over them. Then we come to the most interesting of these four, and that's clinging to the sense of a separate self, that somehow we have the idea that there's me, not me. And I want to read something from Joseph again here. In the fourth of the bonds and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body, which is experiencing all of this because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves around it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. We somehow believe that we're separate, that we're not connected to everything. And that belief, this idea that somehow there's me and not me, is the root cause of everything. It causes all the suffering. All these other ones are layers that are a result of this, in a sense. This is the real issue. And, of course, it's the hardest one to grasp, because it's like, well, wait a minute. Seems pretty real to me. I certainly feel like I'm there and you guys are over there and there's me and not me, right? And it's like, you know, that's delusional, but it seems like really hard to deal with. And it's tricky because, and this is one of the great paradoxes of this practice and this tradition. You have to do this practice and to actually go deep into this practice, you have to have a pretty strong sense of self, pretty strong ego. If you have a very weak sense of self and you start doing this practice, it can lead to, and I've seen this happen, people flipping out, essentially, using colloquial terms. If you don't have a strong sense of self and you start really exploring this practice and you start to see that, wait, oh, there's no me there, this can be extremely frightening and distressing for people. And so we both have to have a strong sense of a self and then learn to let that go at the same time. This is the paradoxical issue of this whole practice. Is we need both those things simultaneously, and we learn to balance. I mean, also we have to understand that you know, when we talk about this idea of no separate self, this is in what we'll call absolute reality, right? But most of the time, I don't function in absolute reality. I function here in the world of relative reality, you know. And if I really believe, well, I'm not separate from anything, you know, then I can just walk into someone else's house and take whatever I wanted because, well, we're all one anyway. And that's what happens to some people who flip out in this world, is they start to believe that because everything is just one giant self, that no one owns anything, or nothing belongs to anybody, or any of that stuff. And in the world of relative reality, that's going to get you in trouble and probably in jail pretty quick, if not worse, right? And so we have to sort of, once again, there's that balance. I have to, you know, if I'm going to function in the world, I have to have a pretty good, solid sense of where the edges of my world is, whether it's my physical body. Otherwise, if I didn't have a sense of where my physical body is, then I'd start walking into walls, which would be problematic. So this is in balance that's always going on. And Joseph has one other thing to say here. I'm quoting Joseph a lot tonight because this is one of his favorite topics, I'm sure. He's talking about something called the craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is the very basic urge or desire to be. It is desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work, or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thought and action has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this. I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. And once again, I want to be careful here, because if we live in this world, in the world of relative reality, we have to plan. You have to plan to be here tonight, right? Otherwise, you would never have got here. Who knows what you'd be doing, wandering around on the street or something. So, but it's like when we plan, we also have to be able to go, but this is just a plan. Who knows what's going to happen 2 hours from now or tomorrow or next year or whatever. We have to understand that every plan we ever make is just gone just like that. Changes, because things are changing all the time. You know, you could have had a plan to meet here, and then, you know, someone phoned and you was a sick relative, and you had to rush off to be with your sick relative. Plan changed. And it's okay. It's not like, oh, I did something wrong. I told Barry I'd be there, and then I wasn't there, and blah, blah, blah. No, things change because that's life. And we know that's the nature of everything. Joseph goes on, he says, on a momentary level, we can see this craving for becoming in our relationship to the unfolding process itself. Even if we don't have expectations of some big, wonderful experience, how often do we seem to be leaning forward into the next moment as if somehow the next step, the next breath, the next sensation or thought will resolve everything, complete everything? We can see this leaning happen when we're feeling something unpleasant and watching for it to change. Ever done that? Sitting there and got sort of throbbing in your knee, and your philosophical mind says, well, everything's changing, so that throbbing's going to go away. But then you sit there waiting for it to happen. Now you're caught in craving for becoming. I'm waiting for this change that philosophically I understand must be going to happen, right? Or we feel it when being with some emotion and wanting to feel it more deeply. This sense of leaning forward, anticipating the next moment, is also a kind of craving for becoming. Here we're not seeing each of these experiences simply as insubstantial, empty phenomena arising and passing in each moment. We're living in a world of wanting. We forget that liberation is not about becoming or getting, not about holding or craving or clinging, but of letting go and letting be. It's hard to let go of all those pleasant things. Sometimes the unpleasant ones, because like at least the unpleasant ones they're familiar and I cling to them because they're familiar. It's like we always, you know, my favorite example of this is driving in the car going to the store. There you are driving in the car, and your mind is already in the store. I'm going to go to that aisle, then I'm going to go to that aisle. You know, I'm going to go buy the cookies and get some cookies. And, you know, but our mind isn't in the car anymore, or walking on our bike or whatever, how you're getting to the store. The mind is already out there planning how you're going to do all that. It's the nature of mind. And as I said, we have to. I mean, if I didn't make a list before I went to Whole Foods, who knows what I'd come home with, right? So we have to plan to a certain extent. So I always get a few things that aren't on the list, but, you know, that's just how we are. How often do we, here's another nature part of this, how often do we think about how things used to be? Oh, it used to be that. Or how will it be when this is over? Do that with the current political situation, perhaps. How's it going to be in 3 years, 2 months, 14 days? Whatever, how long it is. You know? But that's what we do. And it's so easy to go there. And now we're off in the future, or you know, and that's all about just wanting to be that in that place instead of this place. Instead of just paying attention to where we are right now. And let's pay attention, let's do what we can to work with what's here right now. But let's be realistic about it. Pay attention to it. Notice it. And as best we can, be okay with what's here right now. Because that's all we got. All we got is right here, right now. It's all we ever have, is this present moment, and then the next one. And it's always changing, and we never really know what's going to happen. It's just stuff happens. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. It's a poem called Being Present. Breathe, relax, and feel. Take time to slow down the pace of life. Watch the rise and fall of moods, the birth and death of dreams. Feelings and sensations seem so real, yet they shift like changing clouds and flow with the high tide out to sea again. Allow it all to be. No need to grasp or push away. Present with each moment, the whole of you, body, mind, and soul, open to receive. Just be open to receive what comes in the next moment. Such good advice.